Dr. Paul, welcome to With the Wind, Science Revealed, formerly Against the Wind, Doctors in Science Under Fire. I've got a show for you today with two interviewees. The first is Dr. Kevin Stillwagon. He's been on this show before. He is a master of making it clear what's going on with our immune system. And he explains in this episode how our natural immune system handles viruses like influenza, RSV, and COVID. Really good stuff. You don't have to fear anymore once you listen to this show. The second interview is with attorney Alan Phillips. He's tackling a really tough one. Vaccines in the context of custody disputes. You're not going to want to miss it. Enjoy the show. Dr. Paul, coming to you from the heart. What can we offer others? These are crazy times we've lived through these last couple years. And I feel like I just want to connect and be of service and somehow help everyone that's around me. We're shifting. We're shifting from a fight approach to one of love. This is the greatest gift we share. It's our joy in life, our sense of peace, our well-being. It hit me, this does most New Year's, that I've got a lot of things I've got to work on myself. And sometimes, often, it's just physical. But as we've brought to you with Kids First Forever, and we're going to roll out for you this program, it's physical, it's mental, it's emotional, and it's spiritual. These are all areas that I need to work on, and I'd urge you to join in that. This is a great opportunity to just do a little bit of selfish self-care. We've got to put ourselves first so that we're there and available in our best form for those we love, those who are in our world, those who cross our paths. So we want to extend and expand our circle of love. Let's be calm in the middle of a storm. I say we reject fear. Let's embrace love, light, God, if you will. And then we no longer have to do this alone. Welcome, Dr. Kevin Stillwagon. I remember when we were at a conference together not too long ago, having an incredible meal with you and getting to know you. Last time you were on this show, you gave the best discussion of how our immune system works that I think I've ever heard.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here and talk to you, Paul. I really like talking to you because you have an open mind. You have a very loving soul, and you're open to most new ideas, and that's fantastic. And you know, I don't have a string of letters behind my name, but I kind of do have a way of explaining hard concepts like the immune system in a simple way. In fact, I just got back from Canada. I did a 12-city tour through the provinces of Ontario and also Nova Scotia, 12 nights in a row, packed houses every night. And these people were just thirsting for the knowledge on how the immune system actually works.
Yeah.
And it's so important to understand that, because if you don't understand it, you get fearful. See?
Right.
And that's the weapon that the government and the pharmaceutical industry uses. They scare people. They scare people into doing things that they really shouldn't be doing. And
yeah.
So my objective is to try to teach people how that immune system actually works, can protect you from becoming infected by anything. And it doesn't involve antibodies. And that's what's really so cool about this whole thing.
No, absolutely. Well, before we get into the immune stuff, I'll remind our viewers, you are a doctor of chiropractic. You practiced for a long time, and then you were a Delta pilot for over a decade, I believe.
Right.
Yeah. And actually,
21 years.
Two decades. And you actually got forced to retire in 2020 over this COVID and mask issue.
Right.
You understand the ins and outs of the flight, you know, our airlines. I loved what I read that you wrote on November 19th, the Envoy incident. And you wrote, oh, this is so beautiful. I just have to read it. 7:41 p.m. Central Time, Envoy Flight 3556 became airborne from Chicago O'Hare Airport, destined for Columbus, Ohio. 18 minutes later, the flight landed back at O'Hare Airport with unconscious Captain Patrick Floyd in the left seat. He was taken to a local hospital, pronounced dead. Obviously you wrote a wonderful blog about all this, but give me your assessment on all this. What's happened? Why? What do you think's going on?
Well, pilots were mandated to get the shot. And I believe it was done because of fear and the idea that pilots needed to do this to protect themselves from becoming infected and also to protect other employees, other pilots and passengers from becoming infected. We now know that that concept is absolutely false. Fauci has admitted it, Deborah Birx has admitted it, and several other officials in the CDC have admitted that this shot does not protect anyone from getting infected, nor does it stop the spread of infection. But what it does do, and we know this, is it sets you up for a myocarditis issue. This is known in the literature. It's actually being printed now on the vaccine package insert that's required to come with these shots. And Pfizer and Moderna both have what's called a biological licensing application that's required for them to get if they want this, this shot to be FDA approved. And in those documents, they are required to track out the incidence of myocarditis until the year 2027. So this shot is still experimental. They're still trying to figure out exactly what is happening after people get injected with this stuff. And we know that myocarditis can now be an issue. Now, the problem that I have with this myocarditis is a lot of these cases are completely subclinical. There are absolutely no symptoms whatsoever. So we have the potential of having two pilots in the cockpit now that got the shot, they might have myocarditis. And if they do, that's a very dangerous thing because all it takes to trigger a heart failure from a myocarditis incident happening in your heart, all it's going to take is an adrenaline surge and just overexcitement from something that might happen during the flight. Now, I'll tell you, Dr. Paul, aviation has been described as hours and hours and hours of boredom, interspersed with just a few seconds of stark terror. And when that happens, that's when you get the adrenaline rush. And if you've got this subclinical myocarditis, it could, in fact, shut your heart down. The reason is because the myocarditis is actually disrupting the normal electrical flow of energy through your heart. And you can't detect this on an EKG even. The pilot can't feel it, but it's still there. And what it's doing is it's setting up what are called ventricular fibrillations that are very minor. But with that adrenaline rush that's going to immediately call for an increase of the heart rate and breathing and increased blood pressure, all of these things cascading on the heart at one time can indeed cause ventricular fibrillation, where all of the little muscle cells are beating on their own, not in unison. The heart, the blood is not going to pump, and there's your cardiac death.
Is this what's happening. Sudden adult death syndrome, do you think?
That's what it is. That's the sudden adult death syndrome. It's from the second shot or booster shots. It's not necessarily that first shot that's doing it.
Yeah.
And the reason is because when you get that first shot, your body's reaction and the immune reaction to it is to create an antibody. That's what it does. So the shot is going to tell the cells of your body to make a spike protein, right? That spike protein is going to be circulating in your bloodstream. And the normal reaction of the immune system is to create an antibody against that. And it does that. And that's normal. But what's also normal is over time, those levels of antibodies will drop. That's completely normal. If we kept every antibody that we ever made, our blood would be so thick, we wouldn't even be able to pump it. It would be like sludge. And so what's most important with this antibody production is not the numbers of the antibodies. It's the memory to quickly remake those antibodies. That's what's so important. And so we've got these people like Fauci and others that are in the CDC saying, oh, look, your antibody levels dropped. We gotta get you boosted. We gotta get those levels back up again so that you can be protected. Well, I'll tell you right now that that is one of the most dangerous things that you could ever do. And here's why. When you get that second shot or that booster shot, what's it going to do? It's going to tell your body to start making spike proteins again, billions of them. And when your immune system sees that, it says, wait a second, man, I already dealt with that spike protein. I made antibodies against it, and I have the memory to quickly make antibodies against that spike protein. So they should not be showing up in these numbers. But here they are by the billions. Something is wrong. So we're going to activate what's called the complement system, the complement cascade. What's that? Well, you've got about 15 quintillion proteins of 30 different varieties that are circulating in your body, bodily fluids at all times. And when this system gets activated, it's literally like taking one match and throwing it into a box of matches. It takes off like crazy, and it is hyperinflammatory, and it is very destructive. And what it's trying to do is go after any of the cells that are making that spike protein or have the spike protein attached. And so when this happens in the heart, that's called myocarditis. And the dangerous thing about the complement system is it's very aggressive. It is hyperinflammatory, and it will not only kill the cell that has the spike protein on it, but it starts destroying normal tissue around those cells. And that's where we start getting the heart damage that's occurring with myocarditis. So that is one of the reasons why we're seeing the escalation now of myocarditis issues happening after the second shot or the booster shot. And these numbers are clearly evident. Anybody could look it up. You can see it in the CDC records that after people are getting that second or booster shot, that's when you start to see the escalation of these myocarditis issues. So the problem that we're going to have, and I hate to say this, but if we get two pilots that have myocarditis in the cockpit at the same time, we're setting ourselves up for a potential disaster. Now, I got to tell you right at the front here, not every pilot that gets this shot is going to get myocarditis. Not every person who gets the shot is going to get myocarditis. And the reason is because there is a lot of variability in these shots. And I'll just give you a few examples. Number one, where is the tip of the needle when they push that plunger? It's supposed to be intramuscular only. It is not supposed to be in a blood vessel or a capillary bed. If it is, the lipid nanoparticles, which are the vectors in these shots that deliver the mRNA that make the spike protein, those are going to rapidly spread throughout your entire body. And you have a higher chance of those lipid nanoparticles going right into the heart muscle and start creating spike proteins. Okay. So it depends where the tip of the needle is. Number two, you have absolutely no idea how many lipid nanoparticles are in that syringe when they push the plunger. And the reason is because they have to be mixed. And there's a very special procedure that's done. So the variability can be anywhere from 10 billion to 100 billion particles in that shot. And you have absolutely no control over that whatsoever. And the more you get, the higher your chances are of having myocarditis or any other adverse reaction. Here's another one. Not everybody is going to make spike proteins at the same rate nor the same amount. And this has to do with the pH of the cells. It's the cells of your body now that are going to make that spike protein. And this is dependent upon the pH of the cell. The more acidic the cell is, the more spike proteins are going to be made. And this is entirely dependent upon diet and also on certain medications that the person may or may not be on. So there's another variability factor. Here's another one, the presence of zinc in the cell. The more zinc that you have in those cells, the less spike proteins are going to be made. Again, another variability factor. Here's another one. When you get the shot, let's say it's a Pfizer or a Moderna shot, the lipid nanoparticle is encapsulated in what's called polyethylene glycol. And they put that polyethylene glycol in there so that these lipid nanoparticles do not stick together. So if those if the polyethylene glycol has degraded or is not doing its job, you have the chance of being injected with coagulating goo that could very rapidly cause a deadly heart attack or a stroke. And we've actually seen this happen. Here's another thing. The polyethylene glycol that's surrounding these lipid nanoparticles, some people already have antibodies against the polyethylene glycol. So if you do get injected with the lipid nanoparticles that have polyethylene glycol surrounding them, and you have antibodies against polyethylene glycol, they can actually block the delivery of the lipid nanoparticles. They never get to deliver the messenger RNA. And these are the lucky people, because they're the ones that are going to say, oh, I had the shot, nothing bad happened to me. Well, you're one of the lucky ones, because you didn't make enough spike proteins for there to be disastrous outcomes. So those are just a few of the variabilities that we're talking about here.
But you also mentioned the pH of the tissue and alluded to foods. What foods would be helpful in keeping the pH more alkaline?
Polyphenols, foods that are very, very colorful, like blueberries, for example, and dark leafy colored vegetables. Those are high in what are called polyphenols, and those will help to keep the acidity level from becoming too acidic. You mentioned zinc, for example. Foods that are high in zinc include lamb, okay, pumpkin nice. Seeds, grass-fed beef, chickpeas or garbanzo beans, pure cocoa powder, cashews, kefir or yogurt, mushrooms, spinach, and also chicken. So those are very high in zinc. Another thing that's important is to get a lot of vitamin D.
I think if our country or the world at large, vitamin D is so inexpensive. If we had distributed to every living person a six-month supply of vitamin D, vitamin D, we wouldn't have had a pandemic.
I agree with you. It would have been just a huge difference. And so here's the key. You got to protect yourself from becoming infected. That's the key. How do you do that? You build up that epithelial barrier that separates the inside of you from the outside of you. So that epithelial barrier starts with your skin. It transitions into your mouth, through your esophagus, intestinal tract, all the way out the other end. Same with your nose, down into your lungs. All of that tissue is covered with what's called the epithelial barrier. And so anything that's going to negatively affect your health has to get through that barrier, whether it's a bacteria or a virus. If it can't get through, you're not going to become infected, right? And so the key to this whole thing is build up that barrier, build up that fence, so that you can protect yourself from becoming infected. There is something called a mucosal IgA antibody. It's called a secretory mucosal IgA antibody. When you get a natural infection, these are protective antibodies that will be secreted out into the mucosal layer, and they will actually protect you from future infections. Now, the cells that we're talking about, the protective cells that guard that epithelial layer, these things are absolutely magnificent cells in how they work. And there's three of them that we need to talk about. One of them is called the dendritic cell. And this cell is the one that's most important, because it actually can reach through that barrier and grab the thing that's on the outside. It pulls it inside of itself and chops it up into all of the protein parts that make it up, all of them. And then it shows these parts to other cells of your immune system. And it says, you recognize any of this stuff? And if the answer is yes, then cytotoxic T cells get activated. and they will actually destroy that cell that has the virus in it before the virus even gets inside of you. See? That's how that works. That's protection of infection, and it does not involve antibodies. Another one is called the natural killer cell. And these cells are really wild because they don't care what the virus is at all. Their job is to continuously survey that epithelial barrier. And what they're looking for are these little things that all of your epithelial cells have. In fact, every cell in your body, every nucleated cell in your body has these things that are called MHC1 complexes. That's major histocompatibility complex. These natural killer cells, their job is to continuously survey that epithelial barrier looking for those MHC complexes. Now, here's what happens, Dr. Paul. If an epithelial cell is infected with a virus, for a time, those MHC complexes go away. They disappear. The natural killer cell will instantly recognize that and will destroy that cell with the virus in it before the virus is even released inside it. Again, that is protection of infection.
So you talked about how important it is to have a intact or very robust epithelial lining.
Yes.
What are the ways that we can, on our own, sort of boost up our epithelial immune system or lining, if you will?
Well, we talked about two things. Number one is get your vitamin D levels up, and you can do that with sunshine and fortifying your foods with vitamin D. Another one that's critical is zinc, because that epithelial barrier, that's where the viral replication is going to take place, right there. So you want to minimize the effect of that happening with zinc. Another thing that's critical is to eat as much organic foods as you possibly can. But the reason is because our food and water supply has become contaminated with what's called glyphosate. Another one that's very important is exercise. And I mentioned this the last time we talked. You've got to do whatever you can to aerobicize your body. You got to get those essential nutrients and the oxygen that all cells of your body need. And the only way to do that is exercise. You got to get that blood pumping, man. You got to get it moving through your body so that all of those cells along that epithelial barrier are well nourished and any toxins that are there get carried away in the vascular system. And so I recommend that people at least 3 times a week try to get your heart rate up to the maximum value that's recommended for your age.
You know, we certainly are seeing continued COVID. Now there's RSV, flu. People are worried. What would be your best advice?
Don't be afraid. You need to lose the fear, okay? And that's what I'm all about. I do an educational videos that I have on my Rumble channel. And I've also been given the opportunity to actually teach the immune system. It's going to be an online course that's going to be starting in January. And another good place to get education on your immune system and biology and all kinds of other things that will, you know, smarten you up so that you're not afraid anymore is ipac-edu.org. Yeah. And that's a man you're very familiar with.
Yes.
Dr. James Lyons Weiler. He is a fantastic educator. He's got a programs there that you can sign up for almost on a continuing basis. They're not that expensive. And I mean, it's graduate level stuff.
Yeah.
And so if you just expose yourself to courses on how the immune system actually works and where that protection of infection actually resides, not in antibodies that Fauci's so wound up about everybody making. And when you learn that, then you lose your fear, see?
Yeah.
And then you won't be enticed to run out and do something stupid, like inject something into your body, thinking that it's going to give you protection. And it doesn't. Yeah. There is no protection there. It actually destroys that layer of protection. You know, remember I said there has to be a perfect antibody that's created? When you get this shot, okay, you're creating billions and billions of spike proteins. It's your B cells that actually make these antibodies. It takes about 2 weeks to make a perfect antibody. It takes that long because there are very, very precise communications that happen between the T cells, which got educated in the thymus gland by the dendritic cells. The T cells are actually talking to the B cells to make absolutely sure that that antibody that's created will not attack proteins that are normally in the body. But what happens when you allow yourself to be injected with this stuff and you start cranking out these spike proteins by the billions, those B cells can start cranking out suboptimal antibodies almost right away. And they are crappy antibodies. They can react to proteins that are similar to the spike protein. And we found several proteins in your body that are very similar to the spike protein. And one of them is called syncytin 1. Syncytin 1 is responsible for the maintenance of a healthy placenta. And so if you've got this autoimmune problem going on, and it's blocking the production of syncytin 1, you might not be able to get pregnant. And if you do, there's about an 80% chance that you're going to have a miscarriage.
Yeah. And that's the rate we're seeing in the COVID vaccinated.
And here's the scary part, Dr. Paul. There's a memory to make that antibody that never goes away.
Passed on generation to generation. There's a new need for a control group that is the most important control group we've ever had. I always had my unvaxxed patients as my control group.
Yeah.
But now, even if you were vaccinated in the past, if you don't take this COVID jab and you don't take any further jabs, because they're going to just right. keep coming with nonsense mRNA technology jabs, yeah. you are the new control group, because people who fall for this will absolutely suffer genetic damage. They will absolutely decrease their ability to have children, cancer rates through the roof. I mean, yeah. on and on, right? I mean, it's you have to say no to ridiculous things.
Yeah. And it does get incorporated into the human genome. We know that. Scientists have admitted that over half of the human genome was actually inserted by viruses. 10% came from human endogenous retroviruses, which are extinct viruses that don't even exist anymore, of course. And then the rest come from transposons, which are parts of virus genes that can be inserted into our genome. And there was a study that was done not very long ago, I'm sure you saw it, where they looked at the Pfizer shot, the BNT162B2 shot, and found that the genetic material from that shot was incorporated into the DNA of liver cells quite quickly. It happened like within 6 hours. And so that gets into the liver cell line. And so every cell, every liver cell now will continue to make that genetic material. And it changes the genetic function of those cells forever in that one human body. But the danger is, if it affects either the sperm cell or the egg cell, that means that the new human created by the union of the sperm and the egg will have that genetic material in every single cell of their body, and it will pass on from generation to generation. That's dangerous. Yeah, we're messing around with DNA.
Yeah.
It's God's fingerprint, man. You can't be doing that.
No, and it's pure folly. Pure folly.
Yeah, so, because it's your proteins that determine how your body functions. And yeah. so we're using mRNA. mRNA is the message to make proteins. That's what it is. So it's making a protein that our body has never seen before. And our body is not dealing with this one very well at all. I mean, you know right. that. It attaches to ACE2 receptors all through your body. The ACE2 receptor, number one, is supposed to control your blood pressure. So if you got if you got all these spike proteins that are gobbing up your ACE2 receptors, you can lose control of your blood pressure. Not only that, but when they start sticking to the walls of your arteries, that causes what's called little microclots. And over time, you're going to build up what's called ischemia. Ischemia is the inability of the oxygenated blood to get to all tissues of the body. It's the first breakdown of what's called any pathological chronic disease. It takes 2 to 5 years for that to happen if you don't stop it from happening. And we can stop microclotting. We know that we can do that. But if you don't catch it and you let this continue to escalate in your body, you will have a chronic pathology in 2 to 5 years. And we're already seeing that happen. We're starting to see chronic diseases pop up in young people that should never have these problems.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Okay, so you scared the crap out of my audience.
That was one of the first complaints that I got when I first started blasting the internet with all of this real science. They're like, right. Stop scaring people.
You're scaring people, Kevin. But the knowledge is power, and giving us knowledge. So take it the next step now that you've scared us all. And with regards to what we can do, we touched on it already before, but you said that we can deal with the microclots. So how?
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's something called nitric oxide that your body makes. Nitric oxide is known to stop stuff from sticking to the walls of your arteries. And it's also known that if you have enough of this nitric oxide, that it will actually start to reverse what's called arterio or atherosclerosis. And that's pretty exciting stuff right there. So it increases the elasticity of your vessels as well. It makes them more pliable. And so there have been people that have taken products that increase nitric oxide that have noticed a significant increase in their cardiovascular health. And it's very clear. One product that I use, it's called Cardio Miracle. There are other products available, but Cardio Miracle is one that I know got tested, and they have shown. There you go. There it is, right there.
Yeah, I've used it myself, so I'm guilty.
Yeah.
You can get a lot of your nutrients through food, and you're a big proponent of that. Sometimes you've just got to, it's hard to get enough vitamin D from food. So you just have to supplement it.
No, and this is what I'm talking about aviation safety right now. So as this whole program started, we've got a situation where we could have two JAB pilots. And I admitted that, maybe they don't have myocarditis, maybe they do, but it's subclinical. In fact, there was a study that was done at the end of 2021, December of 2021. They went on and looked at over 1,500 young male athletes in 13 colleges looking for if there was myocarditis that was showing up. Now, most of these guys got the shot because back then, it was mandated at colleges all over the place. And so, they did find myocarditis. And the scary part was they found out that 54% of the myocarditis that they found was completely subclinical. These athletes had absolutely no idea that they had a dangerous myocarditis going on in their bodies. And they found that the only way to really find the myocarditis is to use a cardiac MRI. Now, it's expensive to do a cardiac MRI, but it's the best way to find myocarditis. And so what I'm saying is we need to start looking at these pilots and finding out if they have myocarditis or not. And if they do, let's keep two of them out of the cockpit at the same time, at least. Yeah. Probably they're going to be grounded anyway. I don't know what's going to happen. But, the FAA or the airlines themselves have got to start looking. If you don't look for it, you're not going to find it. That's obvious.
Right. Well, thank you for bringing that to our attention. And perhaps you're even poking at the airlines to make them aware of this.
Yeah. Well, I am. This is a serious issue, Dr. Paul. One of these airlines has got to step forward and take Steve Kirsch up on his offer. Steve Kirsch, the billionaire philanthropist, has actually offered any major airline that is willing to do it. Steve said, I will pay for the cardiac screening to find out exactly how many of these pilots have myocarditis issue. That obviously needs to be done. That's the first
free,
step.
Free offer.
You gotta look.
Well, Kevin, it's always a pleasure chatting with you. I know you're traveling, you're speaking, you're coming to me from a hotel room with an airplane coming into your head. you know, you're out there helping humankind.
I'm trying. You are too, Dr. Paul. And I so appreciate everything that you have done and that you will continue to do. I just watched your last podcast with Dee Dee, and what you guys got in the works is amazing.
Yeah. Well, we're gonna keep trying to do what we can.
Good.
All right. We'll see you on the road.
Thanks, Dr. Paul.
Take care.
Enjoy your retirement.
Thank you.
All right.
Welcome, Alan Phillips. Oh my goodness, is it wonderful to have you on the show.
Well, I am thrilled and honored to be here. What a great pleasure.
Many people on this show probably don't know you. This is the first time I've had you on, but you are one of the nation's, if not the nation's, leading vaccine exemption legal expert. I mean, you've worked on this area for over two decades. You mentioned, I had no idea that there's like three dozen different legal exemption categories or subcategories. And you work with clients, attorneys, legislators, activists nationally. You've published, you do presentations. You and I were once together on stage in the US, internationally, on the vaccine exemption rights, pharmaceutical corruption. I was reading your article, Dispelling Vaccination Myths. And that was fascinating. Also, vaccine custody disputes, why most lose and how they can win. Most notably, perhaps what I recall and was horrified with was back in 2019, you were jailed four different times for 79 days and ended up being disbarred for your work in this area of exemption and reporting corrupt government officials, basically being punished for being a whistleblower. Sounds a little familiar. And they wanted to make an example of you so others would be quiet and not enter the area that you were working in. And I'm really happy to know that you're continuing your ability to help others in this area of exemptions just by working with other attorneys. You're not the attorney. You're just an educator, if you will, and that you've helped clients nationally and internationally in this area. You have exemption manuals that are available for people to purchase, and you've got critical information that's not available anywhere else. So thank you for being on the show. Oh, and I just recently learned you're an incredible musician. If we ever get together, I'm not a musician really, but I love music, of course. And I know you've advised over 175 family law attorneys nationally about parents' concerns about disputes and vaccines. And not one of those attorneys really knew you before or what you were speaking about, but almost all of them, 95%, would agree with you after you helped them with how to analyze the legal situation. So, my goodness, thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Actually, the vaccine issue is the reason I went to law school in the first place. So I joke about it. Frankly, Dr. Paul, I say I'm business challenged and proud of it, because most of my work over the years has been unpaid activism work. But I have gone deeper into the vaccine exemption world, as far as I know, than anybody else has done. And it turned out to be a lot broader and deeper than I initially anticipated. So let's dive into some of that today.
So one of the biggest challenges, and people come to me all the time, what can I do? It's when, you know, parents are divorcing or separated and there's a custody dispute, and invariably the vaccine issue comes up, and invariably the parent who wants to do all the vaccines sort of it feels like they have the upper hand. And you've figured out some ways that can be helpful for those parents who legally, one thing you wrote, and I'll see if I can quote it correctly. What the judge needs to do is determine whether all concerned are in compliance with the law. If everyone is, if the children get any required vaccines or are legally exempt, the dispute is over. There's nothing more a judge needs to do or legally can do. That kind of was like, huh. And yet my understanding, what I hear is that people are afraid to go to court. I don't know, you know, talk a little bit about how this information applies. Is it just in the case of a divorce, or is it much broader than that?
So what I'll, there's so many parts and pieces to this, and many parts and pieces to a complete analysis in any given case, but there are some very broad, maybe we could think of as overview points or aspects of this. So first of all, any matter involving the adjudication of minor children, involving a lawsuit, court case involving minor children, states all over the country, and a lot of this, most of it is state law, and state laws do vary state to state, but this is highly consistent around the country. They all have what they call a best interests standard. And what this means is that when there's a conflict involving minor children, now I see this in my work up to this point, mostly with parents who are divorcing or already divorced, and they're arguing about whether to vaccinate the kids, or it could be parents who never got married, but they're still having a custody lawsuit where they're asking a judge to decide, are the kids vaccinated or not? The parents disagree. But this is the same, these same concepts would apply in what are called dependency cases, where maybe one party in the case is a parent or both parents, and the other party is the state, and they're deciding, are these parents neglecting or abusing the children? Does the state need to take temporary or even permanent custody of the children for the children's protection and so forth? So anytime you're dealing with the adjudication of minor children in civil lawsuits, and there's a question about vaccines, the concepts we're going to talk about here today will generally apply, but it usually shows up in divorce cases.
Okay. Yeah. The other case that actually comes up that's real troublesome is when the state has custody. Let's say you're adopting, or they've taken away your parental rights for one reason or another. Parents are going, but I didn't want my kids vaccinated. And the state just goes ahead and does it.
Yeah. So the fundamental overriding point that, as far as I've seen up to this point in time, everyone misses. And let me sort of qualify this by saying I'm not smarter than all the attorneys out there, but I have something different than them, and that is that I'm the only one who has spent years immersed in this exemption arena.
Right.
And it didn't hit me right away either. I was dealing with exemptions for a few years before this dawned on me. So it boils down to this. In adjudicating minor children, when there's a dispute, courts look at the evidence and they make a judgment call. What is in the best interest of these children or child or whatever? And what I bring to the table that's new to everybody is vaccines are actually an exception to this best interest standard. It doesn't apply to vaccines. Now, law is full of exceptions. That's nothing
new.
Why
do you say that it doesn't apply? Because it seems to me, I'm just going to play a devil's advocate for you here.
Sure.
It seems to me, and sorry I interrupted you, that the judge or the state or whatever seems in most of these cases to say, no, it's in the best interest of the children that they be vaccinated according to the CDC schedule, as if that's the standard of care. So the parent who's wanting exemptions or wanting to do it differently than most other people do it, are seen as dangerous or even neglectful.
Right, right. And because of that, so first of all, courts do not decide the science. They weigh evidence. And the majority of the experts, medical doctors, of course, all the state and federal health agencies all support vaccination. So one of the first mistakes that the pro-exemption parents make, and it's a very reasonable mistake, it just happens to be legally incorrect as a technicality. They want to bring in someone like you, who an alternative medical doctor who understands the real science, and bring them in and educate the court and come away having not only won their case, but now a judge understands this and will, you know, never make those mistakes again or what have you. The problem is, as I said, courts don't decide the science. They weigh evidence. And the weight of the evidence for every alternative medical doctor who knows the truth, I'm not saying the truth isn't the truth. What I'm saying is that's not how the legal systems work. They don't decide the science. They weigh the evidence. And the weight of the evidence is powerfully, overwhelmingly, unquestionably in favor of vaccines, because the majority of medical doctors, state and federal health agencies, support and promote vaccines. Now, a side issue. The reason they do that is because of psychological manipulation. And we can talk another time about that topic if you like, because that is core and central to not only the current state of affairs, but what we have to address that our activism communities are not addressing to ever get to a real solution to all of this. But meanwhile, back at vaccine custody disputes, you can bring in an alternative medical doctor at, you know, for most parents anyway, great expense, and they'll tell the truth and the court will say, okay, but you know, there's 1,000 others here that disagree.
Right.
And courts illegally, even if you have an aware judge, I would argue, maybe playing devil's advocate, if that's what you want to call it, that even if the judge is aware, following the law, the judge has to do what the majority of doctors say, because that's where the weight of the evidence is. The vaccine issue is the only one where the legislature has already answered the question with specific state statutes. There are state statutes that say who has to be vaccinated, when, and with what vaccines. And sometimes they will delegate some of that decision-making authority to the health department. But either way, it starts with the state statutes. And those details vary from state to state. But it all starts from the state statutes. Who has to be vaccinated and when, and who can say no and how? In other words, right. Which exemptions are available? What's the procedure for those exemptions? There's something called statutory construction rules in every state and at the federal legal system as well that tell courts and the rest of us how to interpret statutes. And one of the universal rules in all of these different state and federal statutory construction rules is that if two statutes conflict, and if one of them is a specific statute and one is a general statute, then the specific statute, and here's this list of phrases I said earlier, supersedes the general or carves out an exception to the general or prevails over the general statute.
Oh, okay.
So courts' authority, their duty and authority to apply a best interest standard comes from a general state statute.
Right.
And that general state statute is superseded by the specific immunization statutes. The legislature passes health bills having looked at and listened to medical experts. And so the legislature is presumed to pass medical bills that address as best as we can public health policy needs, which includes the management of childhood infectious diseases. They are presumed to pass laws that are in every child's best interest, that are meeting the public health objectives, that are safe. And the prevailing legal consensus is that states are not required to offer anything beyond medical exemptions. So if they offer religious or religious and philosophical exemptions, as is the case in some states, they do so voluntarily. And they wouldn't do that unless it was safe to exercise those exemptions. Because if the court is going to overrule or override an exemption, if an exemption is already in place, the court has no authority to do that. Their only authority comes from these general best interest standards that are, and statutes that are superseded by the specific immunization statutes, which include the exemption statutes. The legislature has, in effect, already determined what's in every child's best interest in the state. So this is not just a technicality that allows somebody, a legal technicality that allows somebody to leave a poor child vulnerable to infectious disease. When somebody says you're exercising poor judgment, the response to that can be, well, I'm just doing what the legislature says I can do, and they wouldn't allow me to exercise an exemption if it wasn't safe to do so. If it wasn't in my child's best interest, they wouldn't give me that right, especially if it's a religious or philosophical exemption, because the state's not even required to give you that right.
And what kind of outcomes have you seen where it used to be 99% of the time the parent wanting the exemption loses. But once folks get your, once attorneys get your advice and counsel on this, what kind of outcomes are they getting?
Well, I haven't, that's a very obvious and reasonable question. I haven't tracked it. I don't have a percentage for you. I will say I've seen some of these cases win using these additional arguments, but these are very tough cases. And this gets into actually an aspect of what we were just talking about, the psychological manipulation. There's this rare, often seldom heard of, discussed phenomenon in the medical community called natural immunity.
Natural immunity.
Hush, don't let anybody hear you say that. Because, no. You know, the point, of course, is that exempt children can get immunity without even developing, without getting vaccinated, and in many cases, without any developing symptoms.
Right. I mean, COVID has illustrated that beautifully. Kids had immunity to a virus that was brand new to humankind, so to speak. I mean, we've had coronaviruses, but this particular SARS-CoV-2 was brand new, and yet kids did very well with it. Many times,
and not getting sick,
So their immune system worked. So, I mean, you're absolutely right.
Just to complete the point, immunization policy is not concerned with the immune status of individuals. It's concerned with the immune status of groups to prevent the spread of infection through a community or group. And you don't have to know the immune status of individual children to achieve that goal, at least under the presumptions under which current policy operates. We can argue, parse out whether herd immunity can even occur with vaccines at all. For example, there are people who say it might happen with natural disease, but you can't really get that with vaccines. But regardless, this is what policy is based on. The legislature allows exemptions because a small number of exemptions is not going to undermine achieving our public policy goals. So when a court looks at an individual child and says this child, you know, has to be vaccinated, they are misunderstanding the public health goals and purpose, because it's not about the immune status of individual children. It's about the immune status of groups, which is achieved as long as everybody is in compliance with the law, either gets the vaccines or has the exemption, at least according to the public policy objectives.
Correct. So one thing I've noticed attorneys do in legal action when they're in the courtroom sparring, it looks like quite a battle sometimes, is they will quote prior judgments to support the case that they're trying to bring forth. So are there prior cases of success in this exact situation? Because this is what my parents who are in this situation want to know. You know, who do I talk to? How can I get help so that I can save my child from being forced to get vaccines that I know are going to be dangerous?
CDC statistics that tell us children are not dying from these childhood infectious diseases. You can attribute that to vaccines if you want to, but the combination of mandates and exemptions is not leading to more children dying. And even if it was, the legislature would have to fix that, not the courts. But no one's dying from these, no children are dying from these childhood infectious diseases, but there are children in every state. And we have CDC statistics telling us how this plays out state to state. There are children dying from automobile accidents, from drownings, and any number of other, horrible and unfortunate circumstances. But the reality is the concern about childhood infectious diseases, while valid, is horribly exaggerated. Here's the point. You make a solid legal argument, but you point out that once we determine that everybody's in compliance with the law concerning vaccines, then anyone who's still concerned about the child's well-being, as we all should be, let's look at the statistically greater risks. No one's dying from the childhood infectious diseases, but there are children dying from car accidents and so forth. So if the children are young, let's make sure both parents are using the proper car seat and so forth. And my point here isn't to try to literally distract people from vaccines and get them sucked into something else. My point is simply to put this into perspective. Yes, infectious disease management and control is an important thing for society to do. But once we've done that, as the legislature has told us to do it, the bigger concern is these other things that are killing children in our state and every state year after year after year. And my understanding, you know, continues to deepen my ability to present more clear, focused legal arguments, for example. It's been improving, I think, over the years as I've worked with more and more of these cases. So people coming to me, what I can do as a practical matter is if their attorney, their local family law attorney is open to it, I can do a consultation with the attorney and the parent. I don't have to have a license to advise an attorney. I sell educational manuals, exemption manuals containing information that, as far as I know, some of it is just not available anywhere else. Nobody has, you never know it all, of course, and God willing, I will keep learning and I try to be open and keep, you know, improving on everything I do all the time. But there's nobody who has anywhere near the level of depth and experience that I do with exemptions generally, with these family law cases in particular. So I do believe that I have information and insights you can't get anywhere else. So I believe I have, you know, something valuable there. I can present, introduce these arguments to attorneys in private phone or Zoom consultations. If they want my help beyond that, I could write draft legal briefs. I've done that dozens of times in probably roughly a third to half of different states. The concepts are universal, apply across throughout the country, but the specific legal arguments in part have to be citing law in the state where the case is taking place, because these are state law cases. Once you establish factually that a parent has an exemption in place, the only question is, can the court override it? The state exemption laws that I've seen are all worded in a way that allows one parent to exercise an exemption. And so I say, Judge, you're normally right, but you're talking about a best interest standard, which doesn't apply. That normal right where parents have an equal say with exemptions is superseded by the exemption law that, as worded, allows one parent to exercise exemption.
Right, but is it illegal for me to do that? I have equal rights for medical decision making. My wife doesn't want to vaccinate. I do. Is it illegal for me to go vaccinate?
If there's not, when parents have an equal say on a matter and they disagree, one parent cannot unilaterally make a choice and act on it unless there's a court order that says, you know, Dad, this order hereby gives you authority to go take the child and get him vaccinated, or some law that allows them to unilaterally go do that.
Well, we're coming near the end of our time here. I would like people to know how they can get a hold of you if they'd like to get a consultation or purchase some of your information.
Yeah, for any kind of exemption issues or even my work, which I've gotten more and more into what I've touched on today on about the psychological aspects of this, not just in childhood, child custody disputes, but the broader exemption and vaccine arena. People can contact me through my website, vaccinerights.com. And I have a free e-newsletter subscription that's available at vaccinerights.substack, S-U-B-S-T-A-C-K, vaccinerights.substack.com. And I welcome people to reach out. If there's something I can do to help people, I certainly will. If not, and there's anyone I can refer them to, I will try to do that too.
Thank you so much, Alan. You are a, how can I say, kind of the tip of the spear when it comes to vaccine rights and vaccine exemptions, and you've taken one for the team in a big, big way. So I thank you for that. I know it hasn't been easy. Help me spread the truth and share this on social media and with your friends at doctorsandscience.com. I look forward to running with you against the wind. Go to our website, doctorsandscience.com, sign up, donate if you can, and let's make this the weekly show the nation's been waiting for. I'm Dr. Paul.